Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
We are ready to move from the historical aspects of Darwin and his life and his scientific legacy into the insect world. And so our next speaker is going to be Kip Will, who is an associate professor and insect systematist in the environmental science policy and management and associate director of the Essig Museum of Entomology, one of the six natural history museums here on the Berkeley campus. And he is, as I mentioned, an associate professor, and he is primarily a systematist and taxonomist with interest in defensive chemical and behavioral evolution, historical biogeography, and the theory and practice of systematics. His studies use a broad range of data types to develop phylogenetic hypotheses for massively diverse worldwide beetle groups, with an emphasis on groups distributed in the Southern Hemisphere. And Kip's going to be talking on a taste for insects. Kip?
All right, thank you. So how many of you ate some insects for lunch? Well, depending on where on Telegraph you ate, maybe not. Insects have been interacting with humans ever since humans have been around. But their actual role in helping us understand the natural world around us has changed significantly. And we'll see by the time we get to the time of Darwin and his colleagues, insects are actually a very important part of our understanding of the natural world, a very important system that wouldn't have been available to generations before them. You know, in the ancient past, people who were thinking about the natural world didn't spend a lot of time thinking about insects, and we'll see why. But they certainly knew that we had useful insects, things like silkworm moths and honeybees that we have domesticated for several thousand years, maybe even crickets used in cricket fighting in China. And sort of another category, annoying insects. Yeah, everybody laughs because you know. And these are probably some of our greatest friends here, things like lice that have been interacting with us for as long as humans have been around. And early on, we didn't even really realize how harmful they were. We didn't understand the kinds of diseases that certain mosquitoes and flies could transmit. So they really were just annoying. So we have useful insects, we have annoying insects. And the vast majority of insect species out there went relatively unnoticed. They were more or less benign, but not particularly important. And humans, even those that were interested in sort of pursuing studies of the natural world and figuring out general processes, didn't spend a lot of time thinking about insects. Part of the reason for that is because of this idea of spontaneous generation. So somewhere in antiquity, this idea came to be that you could get life from non-life, and it was used broadly to explain just about any animal, but especially insects, for which their reproductive life history wasn't known. So if you look at the works of Aristotle, you would see that he had a long list of insects and the things they could be produced from. You could get insects from decaying mud, you could get insects from wax, you could get insects from fire. And even though he and others at the time, you know, knew something of honeybees, they didn't understand the nuptial flight of honeybees and how the female can hold on to the sperm and fertilize eggs over the course of her life. It was kind of a mystery. And so what he recounts is not a natural explanation, but the Egyptian method of producing honeybees, so he claims. What you have to do is you go and you find a bull. You slay the bull. You bury the bull into the ground so it's just his horns are sticking out. Wait for the body to putrefy. That's an important step. Come back, saw off the horns, and bees will issue forth. It's a great recipe, isn't it? And there are many such recipes. No, I haven't tried it myself. I wouldn't recommend it. And my wife wouldn't like me bearing bulls in the backyard. But there were many such recipes. And it was this notion, this general supernatural explanation for the natural phenomena that we could get insects by spontaneous generation. The other way that insects came into being in many stories was what I call limited creation. Because, in fact, early on, there wasn't a lot of the myths that considered that insects would have been necessarily produced by some more omnipotent creator, because, you know, there's something that actually lesser demons or witches could even conjure. So the source of insects was something that was sort of outside of the normal natural world and didn't seem to really be well connected to humans. And they would use these sorts of explanations, like special creation or limited creation, as it were, to explain phenomena that they'd see. And so, and this would make perfect sense to someone. You could go out and you could watch a herd of horses. So if this is a European myth. And you might see the horses suddenly bolt across the pasture, tossing their heads and flinging their tails. And in hot pursuit of those horses would be those dragonflies. Well, the logical conclusion for the person there was that dragonflies were produced by demons or devils and sent to the earth to torment horses. Well, of course, we know that dragonflies, you know, are good aerial predators. They're flying around. They're probably, if they're doing anything, they're doing something good for the horses by actually catching some of those biting flies that probably were annoying them. And we chuckle and we think, well, that's quaint. That was kind of a cute story. But there's not much harm done. But if you think about human history and you think about when we've actually gone to supernatural explanations for natural phenomena, you know that there are many other periods of time where the damage has been much more severe. And our lack of understanding has led to a lot of increase in the devastation. Now, in the 14th century, they weren't going to figure out the transmission route of bubonic plague. But certainly if you tried to tell them that an insect was involved, being the flea between the rodent and the human, it would have seemed completely preposterous to them. Because by and large, the insects represented them to something that was different in kind, not just different by degree, something that really didn't make a lot of sense to study and think about very carefully, because what kind of conclusion could it lead you to that would be fruitful? But we know now that insects make up a huge part of our biodiversity, so we think, gee, that they were really missing something there. These sort of notions persist through the Middle Ages, and finally we start to see a little bit of chipping away at this in the 17th century. And there's just a couple of the important folks in that period that began to chip away at ideas of spontaneous generation and ideas that insects and other creatures could be conjured up. Like Swammerdam, a Dutchman, who took the time to actually study insect metamorphosis and show conclusively that caterpillars didn't just die and then suddenly a butterfly or moth was a new creature that was spontaneously generated, but this was ontogenetic development of a single individual. Right? That changes your view about how the insects fit into the natural scheme quite a bit. And then Marcello Malpighi, mostly known for his work in human anatomy, he really enjoyed his microscope, spent a lot of time looking at things, was the first to publish a detailed study of the internal organs of an insect. And you might think, well, that's a fairly small contribution. But even overcoming the notion that they were worth looking at was something. But actually, when he got in there and looked, he detailed the circulatory system, a nervous system, reproductive system, all of these things, which would seem to contradict ideas that you might spontaneously generate these things from bowls or mud or wax. And certainly didn't make much sense if they were just being conjured up by demons. Why would they need these intricate sorts of systems? Why were these systems so much like other systems we see in other animals? And we start to see the decay of some of these supernatural explanations, although these ideas of spontaneous generation will linger with us well into the 19th century. This is where we start chipping away at it. And insects were a great model for that. This doesn't mean that they're beginning to think about insects the way we do now as being part of the tree of life connected to us through common ancestry. I'm sure that Swammerdam and Malpighi would have laughed at such a suggestion. They were much more likely to have ideas of sort of great chain of being. So at least they sort of move insects in these lower organisms from being something different in kind to being something that actually is at least in the system with us. Right? If we look at this sort of iconographic version that Velades did, you know, humans in the natural world are sort of in the middle here with animals down here above the vegetation. I didn't see any insects per se, but they're probably under the feet of the unicorn or maybe the dragon. Bonnet was more explicit, and Bonnet was somebody that actually did spend some time looking at insects, and he includes them in his graduated arrangement with this struggling little moth trying to get up the step from being down here with the plants. So they're in the system, at least, and that's actually conceptually quite different than having them being something not even worth the study. So now we can actually, as scientists of the period, can legitimize their work studying things that otherwise wouldn't have made any sense to study at all. And they're suddenly going to find that there's a huge diversity of life out there that is going to be useful and is going to be meaningful for study. And of course, by the time we get to the, excuse me, the 18th century with Linnaeus, he carried a lot of weight. Linnaeus took time to describe insects, as did some of the other contemporaries of his. And we see this move from things that were hardly worth noting, maybe there were useful ones, there were annoying ones, didn't really have much to do with us, to where they're actually being included in our classifications and in the natural world and are part of, for Linnaeus, God's creation. That's a fairly big step. Not only that, he began to train some students. He had a student, Fabricius. He's probably one of the first people to actually spend a large portion, if not most of his life, actually dedicated to describing and classifying and studying insects. Another individual, not one of Linnaeus' students, but another early insect systemist, Littrée, also spending his time working on insects, something that wouldn't have been conceivable 100 years before. Why would someone bother? There's Bonnet, the same Bonnet that did the graduated arrangement. He also had did a bunch of studies on insects, including things like aphids, where he studied the parthenogenic reproduction, that is, the females giving birth, live birth, to other females, or as it looked in sort of risque terms to him, virgin birth. But in any case, what we're seeing is in the 18th century, there's a full legitimate study of insects as models that can help us learn something about the natural world, even if their concept of the arrangement and the product of the natural world by a creator is something different than we have now. From there, it just explodes. There's an enormous number of individuals come on the scene, and I'll go through some of them just to point this out for different characters that are along the way. For instance, Alexander Maclay. Maclay being one of these 19th century entomologists who looked at the works of Linnaeus and the classification and decided that he didn't think that that was the way things should be classified. He thought that the natural world should reflect the mind of the creator, and the mind of the creator was logical, and if it was logical, it was mathematical, and if it's mathematical, then we should use a numerical system to arrange things. And he did so by using five, groups of five within five. And he began arranging things that way and was actually relatively successful, because you can imagine once you sort of conceive the world this way, you will find ways to make it groups of five within five. It was in some sort of strange way testable. If he found four things that looked like they could be arranged, he would say, there must be a fifth, and he would go and he would find it. This persisted for a while, and some people actually took this to extremes. I think it was the people who were classifying birds went so far as to make some arrangements that were so ridiculous that people began to take objection to it. And then Maclay also took a great deal of heat from a man named Strickland, who was a contemporary of Darwin and actually interacted with him a bit over early rules of nomenclature. And some of those early Strickland papers really took to task the quinarian system. And basically the burden of data, when they started looking at the natural world and collecting more and more, they realized you just couldn't shove everything into groups of five. Even if it was five fingers of the creator, it wasn't going to work. But the important thing is that we have an entomologist here faced with a large diversity that's this new diversity. They're trying to digest it. They're really trying to figure out these similarities and homologies and relationships. And maybe they struggle in the wrong direction, but they struggle nonetheless. His son, William Sharp Maclay, and the cousin, William John Maclay, also William Sharp, very much an entomologist, William John less so. But they took this and they actually then, from Europe, their work moved into Australia. So we start to see the spread of these naturalists and their ideas and their struggling with classification of things like insects. Same thing in North America, and I could I could go on and on with lots of these heads, but that would be kind of boring. Thomas Say, I want to point him out. Dashing Young Thomas Say, here's the father of entomology in North America, and a couple other examples, George Horn and John LeConte, both important in describing Californian fauna early on in the century, and of course, George Horn having one of the finest beards of the time. But there were many more, and they had many students, and there was this great explosion of intellectual activity, so much of it focused on insects. And if you can imagine, 100 years before, it was barely a trickle with Linnaeus, and just 100 years before that, it was not really known. I also point out Asa Fish, because he was the first professional entomologist in the U.S. So now we've got the point where actually the state of New York is paying somebody to be an entomologist. That's quite an advance from 100 years before, where they're scarcely noticed, and 100 years before that, where they're not paid attention to at all. Just a historical note, UC Berkeley taught its first entomology class in 1869. So we've had it ever since. So it really was the rage. It was all over. And most people that did zoology and natural history were certainly associated with, if not doing some entomology. So it's not at all surprising when these three characters come onto the scene that they step right into that entomological activity. That being Darwin, which I like this steely-eyed look. And two younger men, the younger than Darwin, Wallace and Bates, Henry Walter Bates. All of these spent somewhat less, but mostly they spent a good deal of time collecting insects. All of them expressed their fervor for collecting insects. It was really something that was very much the trend. It was very a suitable thing for young intellectual men to be out doing with their umbrellas and their beating sticks, collecting insects and studying them. There's sort of this social environment of the people that they meet and the contacts and them having these meetings, going out, collecting, naturalizing, and discussing ideas. This is a very important part of both Darwin's trajectory and Wallace and Bates, who were younger and were together doing these things. And this was possible because we had reached a point in history where the study of insects and entomology was something that was now very important. The building of collections, which is sort of the result of much of this, had been going on for a while, and it was the case that most men that had a reasonable amount of means, or one of those country vicars or whoever, had sort of little cabinets of curiosities, and they were building up collections, and it was quite a nice hobby, and insects were a perfect part of that, and many of them collected shells and other kinds of natural artifacts, and including insects. It was also becoming a source of national pride, because this, of course, covers a period of exploration and colonization around the world with a huge amount of material that is flowing back to Europe. And so part of the national pride was establishing and maintaining and building a national collection that sort of represented your international power, in a sense. But that material had a great benefit to those that were studying that, that they were beginning to get a much broader picture of the world in all groups, in all kinds of collections, but particularly this is the case for insects. They were starting to get a sense of this, and they didn't have the sort of numbers that we have now, but they certainly had the notion that the arthropods, the insects, and other arthropods on the planet made up a tremendous number of species. Even in their own backyards, once they started really looking, they realized there was a tremendous diversity out there that needed explaining. And so naturalists like Darwin, Wallace, and Bates, they had this background, not just an enthusiasm for collection, which they definitely had, but also an understanding that if they were going to come up with general theories that were going to explain things about the natural world, they were going to have to spend time doing comparative studies, collecting and observing this big slice of the natural world. What a huge shift from when people wouldn't have even noticed insects for such a purpose because they were different by kind and not by degree. Darwin, see, this is the look he has when he sees one of those beetles, actually. That's why I like it. This quotation is pretty famous. Whenever I hear the capture of rare beetles, I feel like an old war horse at the sound of a trumpet. And he actually expressed many times during his life his enthusiasm for collecting, and particularly collecting beetles. I was having trouble finding the attribution for this, so if somebody knows where this came from, I only could find an internet site, they let me know. But I think it was done by one of his compatriots, one of his collecting buddies back in the Cambridge time. When he was in Cambridge, he recounts this later in his autobiography. He has this one passage that's really great, and some of you might have heard it. He says, "But no pursuit at Cambridge was followed with nearly so much eagerness or gave me so much pleasure as collecting beetles. It was the mere passion for collecting, for I did not dissect them and rarely compared their external characters with the published descriptions. But I got them named anyhow." Just aside, I think he figured out how to trick his classmates into naming them, but I'm not sure about that. "I would give you proof of my zeal. One day, on tearing off some old bark, I saw two rare beetles and seized one in each hand. Then I saw a third, a new kind, which I could not bear to lose, so that I popped the one which I held in my right hand into my mouth. Alas, it ejected some intensely acrid fluid, which burnt my tongue so that I was forced to spit the beetle out, which was lost, as was the third one." Man has a taste for insects. You know I was going to work a pun in there somewhere. Not only that, if we sort of look at this statement, those of us who want to speculate on this, the specimens weren't collected, so we don't know exactly what they were. Beetles you find under a bark that produce an acrid fluid and cause a burning sensation. This is almost certainly in one single family, the ground beetles. Right? And Darwin didn't know what he had in his mouth when he spit that out. He wouldn't know that later in time that a certain group of those ground beetles was going to be a very significant player in debates over evolution. Because probably, although we don't know for certain, this was a bombardier beetle. And many of you probably are familiar, but it's such a great story, I'm going to take some time with it. The bombardier beetles are known to produce this boiling hot ejection of rather smelly and irritating compounds. And they do this with a pair of pygidial glands, glands in the abdomen here, one on each side with a little port that comes out. They have sort of a big muscular reservoir which they use to squeeze this material out. And rather than try to explain exactly how that impacts a predator, I've got some short clips to show you of things. Some of them you might have seen. This is actually part of Secret Weapons, which Tom Eisner did with the BBC, and Tom's my good friend and colleague and gives me permission to use this, whereas the clips you find on the internet he has not given permission for. First, we're going to have a hungry spider and a hapless beetle. And here comes the spider. Looks tasty. Now watch carefully, and you'll see, pop, see that blast of smoke? That spider got a mouthful. He doesn't want anything. He spends a lot of time cleaning. Very distasteful. But how about something bigger? How about a toad? Now imagine that this is Charles Darwin. I'm going to put this beetle in my mouth. Oh, no, I'm not. Let's see it one more time, just because it's that good. There it is. Now, this one's stuck to his tongue, and he can't get it off, which he wants it off desperately. And the beetle, a little soggy, but not too much worse for the wear, walks away, having a wonderful adaptation, allowing it to seek out mates or lay eggs or whatever it was about to do. I've got a little bit of the video clip, which I didn't get a chance to digitize, but I want to show that also, because not only is it this wonderful interaction with the predators as a defense mechanism, but just sort of getting into the mechanics of it. The mechanics are very interested, and Tom Eisner and his colleagues did a great deal of work on this, filming it. High-speed photography, we're getting to see this thing pulse its jets. But it is for us, sorry. Like I say, check it out. It's a great video. I mean, what's more awesome than those beetles and that particular mechanism that they have to eject this boiling hot liquid? It's certainly one of the reasons that I work with defensive chemistry now. But let me explain a little bit about how it works, because then you can see a little bit of why it's so fascinating, why it's generated attention, and why it's generated some attention that maybe I wish it wouldn't have. So here we are, a beetle again. It's got its two glands. We've got some secretory cells at the top. These produce a couple of chemicals, hydroquinone, hydrogen peroxide, fairly straightforward compounds. Hydroquinones, quinones are something that's common in all arthropod cuticle. Hydrogen peroxide, not a very complicated cellular product there. It secretes those. They're stored into a reservoir with a nice tight valve on the bottom of it, and they sit there waiting for use. When the beetle is then agitated, let's say an ant or that spider or something grabs a hold of it, tries to eat it, it squeezes those muscles. It ejects some of that hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide into a reaction chamber. Now, in the reaction chamber, what happens is that it has a light coating of catalase and peroxidase, some enzymes produced by the accessory gland. And when it hits those enzymes, we have a chemical reaction that produces some quinone, water, oxygen, and heat. And so when you collect bombardier beetles, at the end of the day, your fingers are tanned brown because of the hot quinones. And you feel it. I mean, for a large predator like me, it's not so bad. But it definitely has an effect. And certainly for smaller predators, ants, spiders, things like that, it's quite effective, even on, as we saw, the frog and certain collectors, if you try the mouth method of collecting. They don't taste good. As it would happen, then, this beetle, this what I would say is a marvel of evolution, has been picked on, and it has been set up as, is this an example of evolution or evidence for a creator? Because what I've shown you is actually a fairly fantastic-looking thing. It looks very complicated and amazing, and how could you possibly conceive of such a thing evolving? That's the basic argument. And though primarily scientists have repeatedly put out the information to sort of get rid of these arguments, when you go to the internet, you search for bombardier beetle, you will get page after page of things that are not just old pages left lingering around, but stolen video clips with other captions on them that are quite recent from 2008, where apparently the bombardier beetle defies evolution, where they're God's chemical warriors. And if you look in the literature, the still available children's publication on Bombi the Bombardier. For me, a beetle systematist, evolutionary biologist, you might get the idea that it's somewhat agitating to have all this information, misinformation out there. For a while, even the bombardier beetle was the number one claim example on the Wikipedia page for irreducible complexity. That's changed quite a bit since then, and they've dropped it, which I'll consider a small victory. It's no longer listed there. But you're going to run into these pages. You're going to run into questions because people will see it and they'll say, that's amazing. It is amazing. I think it's amazing. But we can explain it. We don't need to go to supernatural explanations. Their arguments, of course, these are the standard arguments. There's nothing new here. Every system that they go after basically has elements of the same sorts of things. We'll hear more about it later. That this is a complicated system, and if anything was out of whack, beetles would explode. I love that. But you'll see it all over the internet that these beetles apparently would spontaneously explode if things weren't right. Some arguments that independently, these components, you know, reaction chambers and accessory glands and reservoirs and things wouldn't have a purpose, so it would have to be created in a whole system. And then this is just a real myth that even the creationists have given up on, if they know anything, that there's a chemical instability that requires either some sort of perfect balance of chemistry or the mysterious inhibitor. And of course, this has never been the case. Hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide, I can take it, I can mix a bucket of it here, and I can stir it and splash it, and it's not going to do anything but make a little dull fizziness. It's not even really reactive at all. Inside the beetle, sealed behind the valve, it's perfectly stable. And the reaction energy is such that you have to have those enzymes. See, that's the whole point of the enzymes. They're ready, and they reduce that reaction energy, and you have an explosion when it comes out. But in its sort of stable state, nothing's going to happen. So that's just a bogus argument. So how do we explain it? Because I'm up here claiming that this is actually a really great example of evolution, like a really tremendously good one. Well, the big problem, of course, is that these arguments are usually set up in sort of isolation. Like they go out and they got one beetle, and they study it and they say, look how fantastic this beetle is. It must have been created, because it defies anything that we can imagine. But if you take that same beetle and you put it into the comparative context, you'll find that there are actually 500 species of bombardiers. Some have low temperature bombardiering, some have higher temperature explosions. That particular group actually fits in a much larger, beetle groups are big, so don't get scared by the numbers. That particular group fits in the larger clade, the larger group, the family, which is more than 40,000 species. All of them that we've looked at, which is a tremendous number of them, have a pair of pygidial glands in their abdomen. Most of them don't explode, but they have all kinds of other compounds. They smell bad, they irritate, they're anti-predatory things. They're just not as elaborate as the exploding ones. But we can see all of the components, all of the chemicals, all of the enzymes that you would need in different functions in different species within this larger group. We and others in the past that have looked at this have looked at about 500, 600 species. We got 240 different compounds in those glands. It's just a great chemical factory. So the fact that it makes something that explodes actually starts to look less fantastic and more like, well, that's not surprising that it happened given everything that's there. And of course, we have a huge variety of gland types that can account for all of the bits and pieces and various different functions in delivering these defensive compounds. So we actually have a really wonderful story that goes behind the bombardier beetle, and it's not at all a good example of the need for a supernatural explanation. The comparative context here is actually really important, because you can't do that if you just have one individual from one place in your hand. And this is something that Darwin and Wallace and Bates all knew, and was part of why they were stimulated to go out and collect. Part of they enjoyed collecting, of course, but they also saw a practical side of that. If they were going to explain natural phenomena in general terms around the world, they're going to have to account for things like insects. They're going to have to go out and look around the world to collect that material, to bring in sufficient amounts of it to have a comparative database to be able to find the natural explanations for the phenomena that they see. And Darwin pursued that throughout his career, really, but very much during his trip on the Beagle, although when he was on the Beagle, on the trip around the world, he had a great many things to do, not just entomology. He was doing paleontology, geology, meteorology, collecting birds and plants. And so the entomology fell into place amongst that. And so he collected a good number of specimens, things that are important, together with his servant, Sims Covington, who was also a good collector, to send back. But it was just one part of his overall thing, but an important part. He sailed around, and he found himself on these wonderful and strange shores in southern South America, and he always took time, even if it was just for a little, to collect the insects, particularly the beetles. And he would write back, and he would tell the people in England. He said, "I'll tell entomologists, look out and have their pens ready for describing. It's exceedingly interesting observing the differences of genera and species from those which I know. It is, however, much less than I expected." So there's been some speculation that because Darwin didn't spend time actually working on his own insect collections after he came back, that they weren't important to him. But in fact, I don't believe that that's true. Certainly he took time to collect them, and he had a notion of what he was collecting. He knew things that were new, and yet he also had this notion that there was a connectivity, that these things weren't so isolated and different, that they were something completely unknown and not somehow connected to the beetles and the other insects that he knew from his training in England. Now, he stomped through forest in southern Chile, someplace that I've been, and he actually didn't like it very much there, if you read his account. It was kind of cold and miserable and thick and dense, and collecting is very difficult, very difficult. Nonetheless, he did end up collecting some wonderful things. It's just a few examples of those. Some of these things end up getting named for Darwin because he collected the specimens or things that he actually discusses in terms of their odd sexual dimorphic characters and things like that. So these are important. And he sort of stows away this information. He sends most of his specimens out to colleagues that he think can do the best job with it. So people like Waterhouse and Kirby and others receive the beetles from him, not because he didn't care about the beetles, because he actually cared a great deal that someone would actually name them for him, which kind of leans back on his Cambridge days when he was getting people to do the naming for him as well. No, he knew that he had so much material in it, other directions that he needed to go. And he didn't send the stuff immediately to the British Museum because he said that they were too much collectors and not enough natural historians. And he wanted the material worked on. And he did complain later that the entomologist worked too slow. But there's a lot of work to be done, what can we say? But Waterhouse was among one of the people, and Kirby and others, that if you go through the origin, you see references to insects and particularly beetles, which is in most of the chapters. You'll see a reference or two at least. He often says, here's some observations about insects or beetles that was done by Waterhouse, and I've also seen it, or something like that. So he does attribute them. It's very important to him, this comparative method of going out, collecting things, observing them in the field, and then making sure that they get into collections and are worked on. Now, by the time that Darwin gets back, and he actually publishes on his voyage, then we come to the period of time when Wallace and Bates come onto the scene, being younger, a different route through the system, self-trained, very intellectual, very ambitious. I can only imagine what fun it must have been on those early collecting trips with Wallace and Bates together, scheming, having read stories like Edward's book on a voyage up the River Amazon, probably knew well the Voyage of the Beagle, and other such stories that were coming back to these 20-somethings that were really fired up in this atmosphere of natural history and entomology. And they schemed together, Wallace and Bates, to go to the Amazon and collect. This was going to be their great adventure, one of them. And they went and spent some time together collecting. Actually, only the first 3 years were they there at the same time, and Wallace was then going to return. Wallace had a bit of bad luck towards the end. He had collected thousands of specimens and had them shipped down the river, expecting they were going to go back to collections in England and other parts. When he had decided to return, he found out that his younger brother, who had been in Brazil, had contracted yellow fever and died. When he showed up at the port, his goods were actually still there. Most of them had not been shipped back. So he had to figure out how to get passage for himself and his collections back to the islands. So he did. He worked this out. He got himself passage, got the material on there, and bad luck struck yet again for Wallace, and it caught fire and the ship sank. So losing thousands of specimens. Now, Bates and Wallace primarily were collecting insects, and so their collections were quite large, but also other things, including some live examples of animals and so forth. And as the story goes, there was only one living specimen that was still alive. It was a parrot, apparently, that could fly from the burning vessel. And now people have looked. They've never been able to find that specimen in any museums. We don't know the disposition of that. But likely, because the men had to spend 10 days on the lifeboat, Wallace had one last chance to see if parrot tastes like chicken. But Bates had a much better trip. Bates stayed for a total of 11 years. They went there in 1848. He stayed for 11 years, so he returned in 1859 with his collections from up and down the Amazon River. In total, Bates collected almost 15,000 species when his time there. 14,000 of those were insects. 8,000 of them were undescribed. It was quite an amazing trip. He was an amazing, amazing collector and an amazing naturalist and observer. So on his return, he also wrote a book. This was sort of part of the way that these naturalists worked. They would get these expeditions. They would go out. They would collect. They would make these observations. They'd come back, and they would produce a number of different works, some more technical, some more for the public. So Bates produced The Naturalist on the River Amazon, and that book is introduced by Darwin, and Darwin actually really raves over it. And of course, he had come back in 59, so it took a little time to process the material. But the great thing was is that all of this material that Bates had collected, all of these observations that he made, when he returns and he encounters The Origin of Species, suddenly all of this stuff makes fantastic sense. And I'm sure that he was thrilled to be able to say, look, I've got this wonderful data set of comparative material from my time in the Amazon. Let's test some of these ideas. And he did, and he published some wonderful things that were very important, including ideas about mimicry. Having observed carefully things like heliconia butterflies and other insects in the tropics, and seeing that some of those that were unpalatable or somehow protected and had very distinctive patterns were mimicked by others that had no protection at all and would have been quite edible if you were eating insects. And this particular theorem was, it meshed very well with the ideas of evolution and natural selection. It was a perfect fit. And many, many studies have been generated since Bates came up with the initial story to start many of the nuances of mimicry and different kinds of mimicry and how mimicry can come up. But the initial idea was really a brilliant observation of Bates during his time in the Amazon. And of course, this is a slide full of things that you might look at and might not want to touch any of them. Because you're thinking, oh, that looks like something that could sting me. But in fact, I can tell you that none of these could actually do any significant harm. We have a moth, a beetle, a fly, and a neuropterin, a sort of lacewing kind of thing. None of them actually have any significant sort of sting. They're probably all following some sort of model. Maybe not this particular one, but a model of that type, that sort of banded pattern is something that they can mimic in order to teach predators not to touch them. And Bates, this was part of his wonderful observations during his time there. So he comes back, he publishes this piece. Darwin looks at it and actually loves it and writes a great foreword to it. Wallace, during that time, so we left him, having been with Bates, split off after the first 3 years. He then, you know, he must have been a little upset. You know, that was a pretty bad turn of events. But it didn't take him very long to recover. Now, for one thing, fortunately, he had some insurance on his cargo. So it wasn't a huge amount, but it was enough to keep him going. And he decided that what he was going to do was not strike out back to South America, but to go somewhere even further and wilder and more wonderful, and that's the Malay Archipelago. And he ended up spending 8 years there. And just to jump to the end, he, of course, produced a wonderful book, The Malay Archipelago, The Land of the Orangutan, a Bird of Paradise, and so forth, when he returned. And of the three, this one's the best reading. Some critics have said that Wallace actually never wrote a boring line. It could be. His writing is quite good and very entertaining. As long as you can put the hunting and shooting of orangutans into the 19th century context, it's okay. It's a different time then, so you have to read it and remember when it occurred. But it's a wonderful story of a naturalist with tremendous enthusiasm, with a great intellect, going out, developing a comparative database by observing and collecting. Of all the collectors, Wallace, he was one of the best. He sent back over 125,000 specimens to collections during his time there, about 65,000 of those being insects. And took a lot of his time to actually study the butterfly, moth, and beetle groups, because those were things that he actually favored, to develop various ideas that he came up with. You know that somewhere about halfway through the trip, while recovering from his fever, he comes up with his own version of natural selection, and I'm going to leave that because you basically know that story. But it was during this trip. And so not only was he out there collecting insects and hunting orangutan and bird of paradise, but he was thinking hard about the distribution of animals and why some animals are camouflaged, why male of these small beetles are actually combative against each other. All of these kinds of observations that he's making, and a keen observer is Wallace. Not only that, he has a tremendous enthusiasm for natural history and beetles and collecting, And he recounts that really wonderfully in the book. One section he writes, "I found a perfectly new and magnificent species. The beauty and brilliance of this insect are indescribable, and none but the naturalist can understand an intense excitement I experienced. On taking it out of my net and opening its glorious wings, my heart began to beat violently, the blood rushed to my head, and I felt like fainting. So great was the excitement produced by what will appear to most people to be a very inadequate cause." Maybe a little stretch for the entertainment purposes of the reader, but I think, in fact, it's not that far from the truth, that Wallace, and in fact all of these, Bates and Wallace and Darwin, really had that sort of gut enthusiasm for their collecting and for building collections and making these observations. Yes, he went there with the intent of trying to figure out these larger ideas about how nature works and why animals are distributed the way they are. But also he had this sort of gut feeling, this enthusiasm for collecting and building these collections. His adventures were quite wild and wonderful. One of the great stories, a little story in his book, they had spent quite a bit of 2 days climbing to the top of a fairly high mountain range in Borneo, and they reached an area that was mostly just rocky substrate and pitcher plants was about the only plant growing. And they had spent most of a day trying to find a good source of water, and there was no water available. Couldn't find anything to drink, and they realized that it was too far to go back down to the nearest good water source, and they had to find something. Well, he says, "At last we turned to the pitcher plants. But the water contained in the pitchers, about half a pint each, was full of insects and otherwise inviting. On tasting it, however, we found it to be very palatable, though rather warm, and we all quenched our thirst from these natural jugs." There's no detail as to whether he actually preserved and collected the insects he strained with his teeth, but he also certainly had a taste for insects. Sorry. Aside from having the stunning inspiration of the ideas of natural selection, which this is my opinion and we can hoot at it, the reason his was so much shorter and he came up with so much quicker is that he tended to think a little bit more population-oriented and probably was less sort of bogged down in the individual adaptation. I think that was maybe why it kind of came on him in a short version rather than Darwin's necessary deliberations. But that aside, he actually built on some earlier work on animal distributions and came up with distribution patterns and the arrangement of historical patterns of biogeography that were way ahead of his time because they had no idea that plates and things could move around the way that we think of them moving now. And they had only ideas of sort of land bridges and dispersal to sort of do that. And yet he was convinced by looking at these animal distributions that this was real phenomena and it was important in understanding the natural world. He says, "It's certainly wonderful and unexpected fact that an accurate knowledge of the distribution of birds and insects could enable us to map out the lands and continents which have disappeared beneath the ocean long before the earliest traditions of the human race." Right? So this is a wonderful, huge leap to be having a comparative data set that's large enough that is based on insects and birds to be able to put together these kinds of patterns, these global patterns, being able to understand them. And that's something that all three shared. They all shared this love for collecting. They also all shared the idea that, we needed this sort of expansive, comprehensive data set in order to understand and explain the general phenomena in the world, and that the way that they could do that was to go out and to collect and then to feed those collections back into the natural history museums, back into the hand of the naturalist, to the taxonomist and the systematist, we would say today, to the biologists that can then understand those patterns. And so we have something of a legacy from all of these and from other individuals in the 19th century that resides in our natural history museums. But then, of course, we're always faced with questioning what we have and where we put our resources and where we put our emphasis. And we have to ask ourselves, is this legacy, this 19th century legacy of collecting and collections, is it still pertinent to what we do now? Is it relevant to the 21st century? Do we have a need for it? Or are they just a closet full of dead bugs? It's a non-trivial question, actually, especially if you work in one of those closets. I don't think it's a hard sell, actually, to realize that indeed the 19th century tradition, sort of, you know, if you can imagine, so we got 400 years to talk about here, we got 200 years before their time, insects really aren't even on the map intellectually, right? We got 100 years after that, we've got Linnaeus, they suddenly start to become part of our understanding of the natural world, be that the chain of being. Another 100 years, they're really forming a huge part of our understanding of the natural world in general. And still, the biodiversity of our planet is largely unknown. There's still a lot of exploration and collecting to be done out there in order to build an even better and more complete data set of information, of specimens, so that we can seek natural explanations for the natural phenomena that we see out there. And yes, some of the things we do still looks an awful lot like the 19th century, but it's not in some sense. Indeed, the insects are out there and we still must pursue them and collect them. And this is the case for all natural history museums, not just for insects. But we have bigger and grander ideas than our umbrella and beading sheets. We can do things like canopy fogging, because we've realized that in the canopies of both the tropical and temperate forest is a huge undescribed diversity that we need to understand in order to get the general picture of life on our planet. And of course, they still are our source of comparative data. Our museums house that and hold that, whether you want to go back and visit Darwin and Wallace's specimens or you want to look at ones that were collected last week. Those collections are still growing, they're still building, and there's still a reason to have many individuals from many places so that we can understand these patterns. And of course, the morphological data is very important to us. But we have technology now that's going to let us even make those collections more available, more important, and increase our understanding of the data. Because now we have molecular techniques that are getting better and better. It's not inconceivable that we could go back and actually take DNA out of a specimen that Darwin collected himself and sequence it if we wanted to, if we had a question where that specimen was appropriate to do that. And so new material that's being added is specifically treated so this can now be done, but also our technology is going to allow us to even step back into the 19th century and sample from the samples they brought us back. Collecting has always been, and collections have always been sort of a nexus for intellectual activity. We talk about Darwin and his sort of cronies, his colleagues, and the way that Wallace and Bates worked together, and they'd have these events, and they had their museums, and these really are intellectual nexuses that allow for exchange of ideas and things like that. But it's not just for us ivory tower scientists. It's something that now we realize we really can use these tools to reach out. And we really want to be able to take that enthusiasm and spread it around, and make sure that we're reaching people that will have the seed for that enthusiasm and develop the next Darwins. And one of the ways we can do that is we have a number of programs like in the Essay Museum where we have expeditions that go to Chile. We have contacts with classrooms here where we go in beforehand, explain what we're doing. We're going down, and this is a biotic survey, so basically it's just a lot of collecting and collecting techniques. The kids sort of follow along by way of the internet and can interact with us while we're on the expedition. It's a great thing, sort of blogging and video and questions going back and forth, so that they get a real sense of what collections and collecting is about and why it's important. Right here in California, we have a great program between the Natural Reserve System and our museums with the K-12 program where we're actually getting students out there in the environment and doing the collecting and understanding what kind of data it takes. And they're participating in these sorts of studies. So our natural history collections are also a nexus for this whole next generation of enthusiastic naturalists. We're finding that our historical data can tell us something about how we're impacting the world. Recently, between Dave Cavanaugh and Sean Schofield and the Cal Academy here at Berkeley, they've looked at these distributions of beetles and high elevations in Sierras. And they can see marked changes in the population distributions. And these are clues to how climate change may be impacting our natural populations. And our museums are the sources for the historical data, but not only that, they're the sources for the data that we can use to build predictive models. And that's what we have in the MVZ, where they're using vertebrates and this wonderful data set that they have from previous surveys to not just look at what's happened already, but take those data and say, if we continue like this, what sort of things are going to happen? So museums aren't just an archive of dead insects with old data. They're actually extremely important to our ongoing research. And I think that actually Darwin and Wallace and Bates would be thrilled and amazed if they could see the size, magnitude, and importance of our natural history collections now. And so the question then that we often ask when we're thinking about where we're going to put our resources, our time, what kind of things we're going to teach, where will our next big idea in biology come from? We don't know what it is. I would say it's probably going to be from someone who has an understanding of what a comparative data set needs to be, how collections and collecting are important to building that. And I think above all, they're going to be somebody that has a taste for insects. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.